Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Ramsey Lecture Series for 2020. I'm Simon Haynes. I'm the director of the Ramsey Centre. And like the rest of the world, we've had to shift to an online format, at least for now. And our theme for this lecture, in fact, is central to this and to what has been happening to all of us this year. If one topic has been on everybody's mind almost as much as the pandemic itself, it has surely been China, where it all started in the new year. So we're very fortunate that our first speaker for 2020 is one of Australia's foremost China experts, Professor John Fitzgerald, who will be speaking on the topic Trust in a Time of Pandemic, the Use and Abuse of Civilizations. We're very privileged to hear from John, who is uniquely qualified to speak on this topic because it bears on the pandemic, but also on the changed world that we will find ourselves living in after it, especially on the future of our relationship in the West, in the world in general, but especially in Australia, with a rapidly changing, much more proactive, more assertive China. I should just mention that we'll be posting the talk in shorter sections or episodes over the next 2 weeks or so, 2-3 weeks, followed by a short Q&A style conversation with John at the end of each section. So there's plenty to keep an eye open for while you are still locked down at home. Watch out also for future lectures in this series, and you can also tune in to our Great Books podcasts being uploaded regularly in the coming weeks, including some topics that we hope will be of interest to higher school certificate students, school leaving students, and we hope of interest also to present and future Ramsey scholars studying for the time being at home. So very quickly, our guest, John Fitzgerald, AM, is Emeritus Professor at the Centre for Social Impact at the Swinburne University of Technology, where he has worked since 2013. Previously, John served for 5 years as representative of the Ford Foundation in Beijing. He is a former president of the Australian Academy of the Humanities, and his publications have won international recognition, including the Joseph Levinson Prize of the US Association for Asian Studies and the Ernest Scott Prize of the Australian Historical Association. So here is John Fitzgerald on Trust in a Time of Pandemic.
Our subject is pandemics and civilizations and the problems of trust in the contemporary world. Our question is whether a country's civilizational heritage can be abused, particularly in discussions around world affairs, and whether cultural heritage can also be deployed in exposing and dealing with abuse when and where we find it. Our focus is on China and Australia, or more broadly, the West. Now, looking about us today, how would we say arguments about civilizations are featuring in global conversations surrounding the outbreak, the spread, and the management of the coronavirus, or COVID-19? Are we at liberty to refer to civilizations and traditions in trying to explain different national responses or continental responses to this major global challenge? Yes, we are. But do we need to resort to civilization arguments to make sense of what's going on? Probably not. So, to begin, how are arguments about civilizations featuring in international conversations surrounding the coronavirus pandemic? In the case of China, there's probably no better place to start than the prestigious Chinese Association for International Understanding, based in Beijing, and one of its prominent media personalities, Dr. Din Yi Fan. Now, Dr. Din runs a video blog called Think Different, Fei Tong Fan Xiang, targeting viewers in China who've not had the opportunity he himself has had to travel and study and work abroad. He earned his PhD from the University of Bordeaux in France and worked for many years as a correspondent for Guangming Daily in Europe. And he spent time as a visiting fellow in Washington at the Johns Hopkins University Center there. At the start of each episode of Thinking Different, Dr. Ding appears, cup of tea in hand, and peering directly into the camera, explains in slow and avuncular tones how the world really works. Now, in recent weeks, he's taken to explaining how the COVID-19 pandemic has come about and exposed the flaws in Western civilization as he sees them and draws attention to the strengths of China's own civilizational heritage. The pandemic teaches us, Dr. Ding says, that human life has very little value in the West, and this is not the case in China. Central to China's civilizational heritage are two fundamental concepts, he tells us. One, asserting the sanctity of human life, in Chinese, 人命关天, and the other, commanding respect for elders, captured in the Confucian term, 孝. Both are anathema to Western civilization. Because, he says, Western civilization is based on a different suite of fundamental principles. These are laid down in classical Greek and Roman mythology. In this tradition, sons murder their fathers, elders eat their young, for fear of being consumed themselves. And at this point in his lecture, Dr. Ding illustrates his argument with Renaissance paintings of the Titan Cronus killing his father Uranus before devouring his own children, and his son Zeus mutilating his father Cronus in turn. More or less a pantheon of deities either mutilating their elders or sinking their teeth into the bellies of infants. And this gruesome civilizational heritage, Dr. Ding continues, explains a great deal about the West and the difficulties had responding to the coronavirus. It explains, for example, why clinics and hospitals in Italy, home, he tells us, of classical Western civilization, had particular difficulty dealing with the virus, just as the myth of Zeus and Cronos would predict. In this case, doctors and nurses snatched respirators from the mouths of the elderly to preserve the lives of the young. In People's China, this would be considered a gross infringement of human rights, but not in the West. It comes naturally to Westerners because disregard for life and disrespect for age are baked hard into Western civilization. For all its material resources, the West lacks the cultural resources for dealing successfully with a global challenge, such as the current pandemic. China, by contrast, has civilizational resources in abundance, which explains why it has done better than the West, despite its relative poverty. So success or failure in managing the pandemic comes down in the end to the strengths or weaknesses of a state's civilizational heritage. Well, we could probably agree with Dr. Ding that classical mythology does have a place in the tapestry of Western civilization. Along, we might add, with Judeo-Christian religious traditions, Norse legends, Celtic fairy tales, and much else besides. And there are good reasons for thinking these still matter in the contemporary world. But there are few compelling reasons for thinking that the tragedy which befell northern Italy under the coronavirus pandemic had anything to do with latent collective memories of Zeus or Cronos. There are simpler, contingent explanations for the arrival, the spread, and the impact of the pandemic that don't require us to fall back on vague civilization claims. And most of these contingencies involve People's China. The virus entered northern Italy through residents from China, mainly from Wuhan. And it spread rapidly because the government of China was slow in sharing information with its own people and with the global community for some weeks over Chinese New Year, when many hundreds of millions of people would normally be expected to take to the roads, to the rail, to the air, to visit family and friends in China and abroad. The mortality rate was especially high in northern Italy because the speed and the scale of infections overwhelmed the local public health system, as they had done in Wuhan, sadly. Decisions had to be taken around the allocation of respirators and other health equipment because there was insufficient to go around. While we can't be certain about the criteria that were employed in their allocation, Australian ethicist Peter Singer has indicated that all decisions were taken with ethical considerations in mind, that is, decisions surrounding the allocation of equipment and resources. When resources are scarce, choices are made in every system. The New York Times reports that when personal protective equipment was scarce in Wuhan, for example, available supplies were first distributed to party and government officials, ahead of health workers and infected citizens. Again, we don't need to resort to hoary civilizational claims to explain why communist cadres enjoy special privileges in China, any more than we need to fall back on the cult of Zeus to explain contemporary health priorities in Milan. Party apparatchiks enjoy special privileges in China for the same reason their counterparts in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe did back in their day. 6 decades ago, Mulavangilas explained why in his landmark study, The New Class, published in 1957. In this book, Gilas pointed out that communist parties in power, rather than doing away with privileged classes, as Marxism said they should, in fact, make a privileged class of their own party functionaries, their apparatchiks. Everything else about communist systems, to quote Gilas, is a sham and an illusion, unquote. I'd argue that any claim Beijing's handling of the coronavirus reveals a civilizational revival in Xi Jinping's China is an illusion and a sham as well. And in evidence, I submit Dr. Ding and his program.
Well, that's been really, really fascinating, John. And look, just to start off, and in relation to your account, amazing account of the activities of Dr. Ding, I don't suppose we need to dwell on his extraordinary comments about the behavior of doctors and nurses in Italy vis-a-vis China. Let's sort of draw a veil over that one. But I'm tempted to comment that Italy itself is a major participant in China's Belt and Road Initiative, up to a total potentially, I think, of contracts worth $20 billion. And that means a lot of Chinese physical and investment presence in northern Italy. So whatever they may think, whatever Dr. Ding may think, this is clearly an important place for China. But my question's slightly different, John. So my question is, I wonder if you could draw a little bit on your own experience and your observation of life in China and since you've left, the general level of public discourse and so on, and speak a little to how much credence ordinary, educated, non-party Chinese people, good faith citizens in China, would give to this sort of thing, this sort of comment by people like Dr. Ding. Is it all taken with a pinch of salt? Does a constant drip feed of commentary like this kind of eventually leave its mark? Are there contrasting sources of commentary and information on the West against which people would compare this kind of thing? Just if you could just comment a little bit for us on that.
Sure. Well, we shouldn't overrate Dr. Ding's impact or influence. There'd be several hundred thousand viewers of his program, perhaps still under 500,000, and in China, that's not a great many. That said, the issue is this, that there are very few countervailing voices to what he says. There's no counter-narrative. If somebody were to speak up, perhaps in defense of liberal Western values or in defense of the West's role historically in China, they'd likely find themselves arrested and placed on trial. So in this kind of arid public, or environment of arid public debate, the effect can be that when there's only one voice or one or two voices saying outlandish things, they come to seem quite reasonable over time. So while most people, I think, in China wouldn't credit Dr. Ding's civilization explanations for the differences between China and the West, the absence of alternative voices means that in time, it could well be that this kind of view prevails.